Savitri, Book 10, The Book of the Double Twilight, Canto 1, The Dream Twilight of the Ideal. This is Part 2. It's on pages 601 through 606. Savitri has been on a journey in eternal night. She has been following Death as he takes Satyavan's soul through the darkness of his kingdom. For Savitri, it has also been a journey of self-discovery. At the same time that Savitri experiences the darkness created by the death process, which has influenced all of humanity since man's beginning, she also attains the consciousness of her own darkness. When she entered the plane of the inconscient, the immense refusal of the eternal no fell upon all that claims here to be truth and God and conscious self. It fell upon the revealing word and the creative rapture of mind and on love and delight and knowledge. Everything was negated. After going through this darkness, where everything was negated, Savitri lost sight of Satyavan, and her togetherness with him fell to abysmal loneliness. This lasted until, as Sri Aurobindo wrote, her heavy, long monotony of pain tardily of its fierce self-torture tired. Savitri got tired of making herself suffer. We all do this to ourselves. When she got tired of her own self-torture, as Sri Aurobindo calls it, then the immortal light of the Supreme's all-love began to gleam in the darkness. And it revealed to Savitri's darkness the soul of its dread. Then Savitri awoke to her own lost self. Her soul was able to act. She was able to conquer what was left of her own fear and dread, and she spoke to death for the first time. She was able to face death and to declare that death was a falsehood. About herself, she said, "Conscious of immortality, I walk. A victor spirit, conscious of my force, not as a suppliant to thy gates I came. Unslain I have survived the clutch of night." Then, as they continued to move on death's road in the darkness, that growing immortal light of consciousness revealed more of Savitri's own darkness to her. She has to surrender every bit of her ignorance in order to be able to battle for the truth of her own immortality and Satyavan's immortality. To have the power of truth that conquers death, Savitri must be the all-love of the Supreme without any darkness of ignorance. This means that she has to accept to be conscious of death's darkness within herself so that she can conquer it within herself. Only then can she conquer the darkness of death which is outside of her. We all have to do the same. We have to make the effort to have a regular discipline of looking honestly at ourselves to know our own falsehoods. We've gone through Savitri's yoga with her in Book 7, the Book of Yoga. She knew she was going to have to face the ordeal of Satyavan's death and the mighty task of conquering death in order to bring Satyavan back. She did all she could to prepare herself. She just didn't sit and do nothing and believe that when the time came, it would all work out somehow. All of Savitri's effort and preparation was important. Sincere hard work always pays off. Now Savitri has made the habit within herself to work on everything that needs to be done for her own progress. She can concentrate on it. She's made the habit of concentration, and she will change more quickly. These things are not easy for anyone to do, because our own darkness and unconsciousness is hiding in the physical matter of our bodies and in our mental and vital parts. But it is certainly worth doing. Truth is a more powerful force than ignorance and falsehood. When the light of truth comes, darkness is gone automatically. This is the way our universe is made, because the power of truth is invincible. Falsehood cannot stand before the pure light of truth. When Sri Aurobindo writes these things about Savitri, the woman, he's also writing them about us. On another level, he is writing about the Divine Mother incarnated as Savitri, who is the creative force and energy and power of the Supreme All Love. And he is also writing about how it is time for the light of truth consciousness to come into the creation, to change the whole death process. We saw last time that he wrote that at this stage in Savitri's battle with death, the darkness of this stage of Savitri's journey is defeated. And he told us why. He wrote, "All here is a mystery of contraries, darkness, a magic of some self-hidden light, suffering, some secret rapture's tragic mask, and death, an instrument of perpetual life. Although death walks beside us on life's road, a dim bystander at the body's start, and a last judgment on man's futile works, other is the riddle of its ambiguous face. The inconscient world is the spirit's self-made room, eternal night, shadow of eternal day. Night is not our beginning, nor our end. She is the dark mother in whose womb we have hid safe from too swift awaking to world pain. We came to her from a supernal light. By light we live, and to the light we go. Here, in this seat of darkness, mute and lone, in the heart of everlasting nothingness, light conquered now, even by that feeble beam. Its faint infiltration drilled the blind, deaf mass. Almost it changed into a glimmering sight that housed the phantom of an aureate sun, whose orb pupilled the eye of nothingness. A golden fire came in and burned night's heart. Her dusky mindlessness began to dream. The inconscient conscious grew. Night felt and thought. Assailed in the sovereign emptiness of its reign, the intolerant darkness paled and drew apart, till only a few black remnants stained that ray." When we are doing yoga sadhana, we can see that when we are honest with ourselves, the light of truth prevails over the darkness. This light and power of truth in us is our own honesty. It works when we are honest with our own self, and when we are honest in all the parts of our lives. Mother named a flower mental honesty. Her comment about this quality is, "Does not try to deceive others, nor to deceive itself." We saw that Savitri was hiding certain ideas inside herself, which made her comments to death dishonest. She didn't realize it until the light showed her that she was clinging to the desire to live, instead of being completely free from all personal desire and completely surrendered to the divine. It also showed her that she harbored feelings of spiritual pride by believing that she was greater than other things in the creation because she was conscious of her own immortality. We saw how badly she felt and how much she suffered when she faced her own dishonesty. In one of Mother's classes to the ashram school students, Mother spoke in great detail about mental honesty. A student asked her, "Sweet Mother, what does mental honesty mean exactly?" And Mother said, "It is a mind that does not attempt to deceive itself. And in fact, it is not an attempt, for it succeeds very well in doing it." It would seem that in the ordinary psychological constitution of man, the almost constant function of the mind is to give an acceptable explanation of what goes on in the desire being, the vital, the most material parts of the mind, and the subtlest parts of the body. There is a kind of general complicity in all the parts of the being to give an explanation, and even a comfortable justification for everything we do in order to avoid as far as possible the painful impressions left by the mistakes we commit and undesirable movements. For instance, unless one has undergone or taken up a special training, whatever one does, the mind gives itself a favorable enough explanation of it so that one is not troubled. Only under the pressure of outer reactions or circumstances or movements coming from other people does one gradually consent to look less favorably at what one is and does, and begins to ask oneself whether things could not be better than they are. Spontaneously, the first movement is what is known as self-defense. One puts oneself on one's guard, and quite spontaneously, one wants a justification for the smallest things, absolutely insignificant things. It is a normal attitude in life. And explanations, one gives them to oneself. It is only under the pressure of circumstances that one begins to give them to others or to another. But first, one makes oneself very comfortable. First thing, it was like that, for it had to be like that, and it happened because of this, and it is always the fault of circumstances or other people. And it truly requires an effort, unless, as I say, one has undergone a discipline, has acquired the habit of doing it automatically, it requires an effort to begin to understand that perhaps things are not like this, that perhaps one has not done exactly what one ought to have done or reacted as one should. And even when one begins to see it, a much greater effort is needed to recognize it officially. When one begins to see that one has made a mistake, the first movement of the mind is to push it into the background and to put a cloak in front of it, the cloak of a very fine little explanation. And as long as one is not obliged to show it, one hides it. This is what I call lack of mental honesty. First, one deceives oneself by habit. But even when one begins not to deceive oneself, instinctively there is a movement of trying to deceive oneself in order to feel comfortable. And so a still greater step is necessary once one has understood that one was deceiving oneself, to confess frankly, "Yes, I was deceiving myself." All these things are so habitual, so automatic, as it were, that you are not even aware of them. But when you begin to want to establish some discipline over your being, you make discoveries which are really tremendously interesting. When you have discovered this, you become aware that you are living constantly in a, the best word is self-deception, a state of willful deceit. That is, you deceive yourself spontaneously. It is not that you need to reflect. Spontaneously, you put a pretty cloak over what you have done so that it doesn't show its true colors. And all this for things which are so insignificant, which have so little importance. It would be understandable, wouldn't it, if recognizing your mistake had serious consequences for your very existence? The instinct of self-preservation would make you do it as a protection. But that is not the question. It concerns things which are absolutely unimportant, of no consequence at all, except that of having to tell yourself, I have made a mistake. This means that an effort is needed in order to be mentally sincere. There must be an effort. There must be a discipline. Of course, I am not speaking of those who tell lies in order not to be caught, for everybody knows that this should not be done. But the other kind of deception is much more spontaneous, and it is so habitual that one is not aware of it. So, when we speak of mental honesty, we speak of something which is acquired by a very constant and sustained effort. You catch yourself, don't you? You suddenly catch yourself in the act of giving yourself somewhere in your head, or here, and when Mother says here, she indicates the heart. Here, it is more serious, giving a very favorable little explanation. And only when you can get a grip on yourself there, hold fast, and look at yourself clearly in the face, and say, do you think it is like that? Then, if you are very courageous and put a very strong pressure, in the end you tell yourself, yes, I know very well that it is not like that. It sometimes takes years. Time must pass. One must have changed much within oneself. One's vision of things must have become different. One must be in a different condition, in a different relation with circumstances, in order to see clearly, completely, how far one was deceiving oneself. And, at that moment, one was convinced that one was sincere. It is probable that perfect sincerity can only come when one rises above this sphere of falsehood that is life as we know it on earth, mental life, even higher mental life. When one springs up into the higher sphere, into the world of truth, one will be able to see things as they truly are. And seeing them as they are, one will be able to live them in their truth. Then all falsehoods will naturally crumble. And since the favorable explanations will no longer have any purpose, they will disappear. For there will be nothing left to explain. Things will be self-evident. Truth will shine through all forms. The possibility of error will disappear. From what Mother says, it looks like mental honesty is a lifetime work for anyone who aspires to be conscious. It works in more ways than just not making false excuses and reasons for what we do. Our mind is always bringing up the habitual thoughts from our past and the usual opinions and ideas from the outside world, which is full of falsehood. Our vital being is always repeating feelings we have had about ourselves and other people and our past reactions to experiences we have had. To work to have truth consciousness, we have to apply the effort, the discipline that Mother speaks of, to all of this also. This also takes years to change, just as Mother said, our mental view of our own actions takes years. But with real sustained inner work, we can develop the habit of seeing how we think and feel about everything, and knowing when these thoughts and feelings are false. Then we can reject them. We can make a conscious effort to have a higher, truthful thought, and an accurate and more pure feeling about each situation we are in. This also applies to our memories of the past. Mental honesty is absolutely necessary to see what we were in the past. When you begin to practice this regularly, you'll see that you're not honest with yourself at all, and all the time you believe that you were. In this canto today, Sri Aurobindo writes about how beautiful our ideals can be, but he shows us also how they can be falsehoods which delay our progress. It depends on us. Savitri's consciousness has now been purified by her own mental honesty, looking at her own separative ignorance. She enters a beautiful world where she can expect light and love and joy and delight because the darkness of falsehood is gone. To begin this part of the canto about the dream twilight of the ideal, Sri Aurobindo writes, "There is a morning twilight of the gods. Miraculous from sleep, their forms arise, and gods' long nights are justified by dawn. There breaks a passion and splendor of new birth, and hue-winged visions stray across the lids. Heaven's chanting heralds waken dim-eyed space. Past was the heaviness of the eyeless dark, and all the sorrow of the night was dead." Savitri moves into a dream twilight where everything speaks of a beautiful future, but everything stays the same, and never does the full beautiful promise of the future become real. The light of truth consciousness does not shine here, so nothing is disturbed out of its satisfying dream, because it has to realize what it really is. This state of consciousness is a beautiful escape from going on with life, no question of facing ourselves honestly. This place needs no effort or discipline for us to receive what it has to give, because nothing is very clear, or even very real, and we never get it. Everything is indistinct and vague, but experienced as sweetness and happiness. It is a place where people can choose to escape from facing themselves. Sri Aurobindo writes, "But nothing there was fixed or stayed for long. No mortal feet could rest upon that soil. No breath of life lingered embodied there. There was a strange consistency of shapes, and the same thoughts were constant passers-by, and all renewed unendingly its charm, alluring ever the expectant heart, like music that one always waits to hear, like the recurrence of a haunting rhyme." Through all this, Savitri continues to follow her husband. Because of her inner efforts, fear is gone. Now she moves in a safe, misty, satisfying dream for a while. Sri Aurobindo writes, "Journeying, she wished no end. As one through clouds travels upon a mountain ridge and hears, arising to him out of hidden depths, sound of invisible streams, she walked besieged by the illusion of a mystic space, a charm of bodily touches felt and heard, a sweetness as of voices high and dim, calling like travelers upon seeking winds, melodiously, with an alluring cry. As if a music old yet ever new, moving suggestions on her heartstrings dwelt. Thoughts that no habitation found, yet clung with passionate repetition to her mind. Desires that hurt not, happy only to live. Always the same, and always unfulfilled, sang in the breast like a celestial lyre. Savitri has some relief from the very hard work she has had to do so far. She has accomplished a lot. She is free from fear. This is a big yogic step, because we have fear in the very cells of our body. She has confronted the spirit of death with the truth of his falsehood, and death has not been able to stop her or make her turn back and give up the battle for Satchavan's soul. She has gotten death to restore Satchavan's father's sight and his kingdom. Now she is comforted in a lovely space where there is nothing to do and nothing to worry about. And she certainly has not forgotten about Satchavan. Sri Aurobindo writes, thus all could last, yet nothing ever be. In this beauty, as of mind made visible, dressed in its rays of wonder, Satchavan before her seemed the center of its charm, head of her loveliness of longing dreams, and the captain of the fancies of her soul. Even the dreadful majesty of death's face and its somber sadness could not darken nor slay the intangible luster of those fleeting skies. The somber shadow, sullen, implacable, made beauty and laughter more imperative. Enhanced by his gray, joy grew more bright and dear. His dark contrast edging ideal sight deepened unuttered meanings to the heart. Pain grew a trembling undertone of bliss, and transience, immortality's floating hem. A moment's robe in which she looked more fair, its antithesis sharpening her divinity. Savitri has not forgotten her mighty task, and she is not deceiving herself. In this region of twilight and mist, she has some relief, but her high conscious spirit remains untouched. To end this canto of ideal twilight dreams that never result in anything at all, Sri Aurobindo writes, half vanquished by the dream happiness around, a while she moved on an enchantment soil, but still remained possessor of her soul. Above, her spirit, in its mighty trance, saw all, but lived for its transcendent task, immutable, like a fixed eternal star. The Book of the Double Twilight, the dream twilight of the ideal. There is a morning twilight of the gods. Miraculous from sleep their forms arise, and God's long nights are justified by dawn. There breaks a passion and splendor of new birth, and hue-winged visions stray across the lids. Heaven's chanting heralds waken dim-eyed space. The dreaming deities look beyond the scene and fashion in their thoughts the ideal worlds sprung from a limitless moment of desire that once had lodged in some abysmal heart. Past was the heaviness of the eyeless dark, and all the sorrow of the night was dead. Surprised by a blind joy with groping hands, like one who wakes to find his dreams were true, into a happy, misty twilight world, where all ran after light and joy and love, she slipped. There, far-off raptures drew more close, and deep anticipations of delight, forever eager to be grasped and held, were never grasped, yet breathed strange ecstasy. A pearl-winged indistinctness fleeting swam, an air that dared not suffer too much light. Vague fields were there, vague pastures gleamed, vague trees, vague scenes dim-hearted in a drifting haze. Vague cattle white roamed, glimmering through the mist. Vague spirits wandered with a bodiless cry. Vague melodies touched the soul and fled, pursued into harmonious distances unseized. Forms subtly elusive and half-luminous powers, wishing no goal for their unearthly course, strayed happily through vague ideal lands, or floated without footing, or their walk left steps of reverie on sweet memory's ground, or they paced to the mighty measure of their thoughts, led by a low far chanting of the gods. A ripple of gleaming winds crossed the far sky. Birds like pale-bosomed imaginations flew with low, disturbing voices of desire, and half-heard lowings drew the listening ear, as if the sun god's brilliant kine were there, hidden in mist and passing towards the sun. These fugitive beings, these elusive shapes, were all that claimed the eye and met the soul, the natural inhabitants of that world. But nothing there was fixed or stayed for long. No mortal feet could rest upon that soil. No breath of life lingered embodied there. In that fine chaos, joy fled dancing past, and beauty evaded settled line and form, and hid its sense in mysteries of hue. Yet gladness ever repeated the same notes and gave the sense of an enduring world. There was a strange consistency of shapes, and the same thoughts were constant passers-by, and all renewed unendingly its charm, alluring ever the expectant heart, like music that one always waits to hear, like the recurrence of a haunting rhyme. One touched incessantly things never ceased, a skirt of worlds invisibly divine. As if a trail of disappearing stars, there showered upon the floating atmosphere colors and lights and evanescent gleams that called to follow into a magic heaven. And in each cry that fainted on the ear, there was the voice of an unrealized bliss. An adoration reigned in the yearning heart, a spirit of purity, an elusive presence of fairy beauty and ungrasped delight, whose momentary and escaping thrill, however unsubstantial to our flesh and brief, even in imperishableness, much sweeter seemed than any rapture known earth or all-conquering heaven can ever give. Heaven, ever young, and earth, too firm and old, delay the heart by immobility. Their raptures of creation last too long. Their bold formations are too absolute. Carved by an anguish of divine endeavor, they stand up sculptured on the eternal hills, or quarried from the living rocks of God, win immortality by perfect form. They are too intimate with eternal things. Vessels of infinite significances, they are too clear, too great, too meaningful. No mist or shadow soothes the vanquished sight. No soft penumbra of incertitude. These only touch the golden hem of bliss, the gleaming shoulder of some godlike hope, the flying feet of exquisite desires. On a slow, trembling brink between night and day, they shone like visitants from the morning star, satisfied beginnings of perfection, first tremulous imaginings of a heavenly world. They mingle in a passion of pursuit, thrilled with a spray of joy too slight to tire. All in this world was shadowed forth, not limned, like faces leaping on a fan of fire, or shapes of wonder in a tinted blur, like fugitive landscapes painting silver mists. Here vision fled back from the sight, alarmed, and sound sought refuge from the ear's surprise, and all experience was a hasty joy. The joys here snatched were half-forbidden things, timorous soul bridles delicately veiled, as when a goddess' bosom dimly moves to first desire, and her white soul transfigured, a glimmering Eden crossed by fairy gleams trembles to expectation's fiery wand, but nothing is familiar yet with bliss. All things in this fair realm were heavenly strange, in a fleeting gladness of untired delight, in an inconsistency of magic change. Past vanishing hedges, hurrying hints of fields, mid swift escaping lanes that fled her feet, journeying, she wished no end. As one through clouds travels upon a mountain ridge and hears, arising to him out of hidden depths, sound of invisible streams, she walked, besieged by the illusion of a mystic space, a charm of bodiless touches felt and heard, a sweetness as of voices high and dim, calling like travelers upon seeking winds, melodiously, with an alluring cry. As if a music old yet ever new, moving suggestions on her heartstrings dwelt, thoughts that no habitation found, yet clung with passionate repetition to her mind. Desires that hurt not, happy only to live, always the same, and always unfulfilled, sang in the breast like a celestial lyre. Thus all could last, yet nothing ever be. In this beauty, as of mind made visible, dressed in its rays of wonder, Satyavan before her seemed the center of its charm, head of her loveliness of longing dreams, and captain of the fancies of her soul. Even the dreadful majesty of death's face and its somber sadness could not darken nor slay the intangible luster of those fleeting skies. The somber shadow, sullen, implacable, made beauty and laughter more imperative. Enhanced by his gray, joy grew more bright and dear. His dark contrast, edging ideal sight, deepened unuttered meanings to the heart. Pain grew a trembling undertone of bliss, and transience, immortality's floating hymn, a moment's robe in which she looked more fair, its antithesis sharpening her divinity. A comrade of the ray and mist and flame, by a moon-bright face, a brilliant moment drawn, almost she seemed a thought mid floating thoughts, seen hardly by a visionary mind, amid the white musings of the soul. Half vanquished by the dream happiness around, a while she moved on an enchantment's soil, but still remained possessor of her soul. Above, her spirit in its mighty trance saw all, but lived for its transcendent task, immutable like a fixed eternal star.